Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of September 2025, and this is episode 367. On today's show, we feature a talk given by Professor Gary Sheffield at the London Pride Conference held in June 2024. Gary's talk compares and contrasts the London Territorial Force in the First and Second World Wars, exploring how its role, composition, and reputation evolved over those two conflicts. This conference was held in June 2024.
Thank you very much indeed. I'd say there's 115 reasons why Arsenal are the real Premier League champions, but we won't go any further than that. I'd like to thank everybody, Charles, Richard, Tom, for putting this project together and, of course, for asking me to give this keynote address. The subject is very dear to my heart. I've got a long-standing interest in Britain's auxiliary forces, and although I am now in exile in the Home Counties, I'm a Londoner born and bred. As for the title, I must say I was, for me, London Pride only has one meaning. And I was very surprised indeed to find out that it's also a flower and a patriotic song written in 1941 by Noel Coward. It's amazing what you can find out on the internet. Just before I begin the talk, if I could just actually dedicate today's talk to Jeff Inglis, known to many of us here, stalwart of the Western Front Association, some really good work on London units in the First World War, died sadly too young during COVID, though not of COVID, and I just want to dedicate this talk to his memory. Okay, well, in this brief talk, I'm going to provide some context for the day by making some general points about the territorials in the era of total war, so roughly 1900 to 1945, focusing, though not exclusively, on London units. And let's establish what we're talking about. Now, what many people call the amateur military tradition, I call part-time civilian soldiering. The reason for that is I think that the stress on soldiering is important, and amateur can be confused with amateurish, and many people took it very, very seriously indeed. This particular television programme, I thought, neatly captured the complicated way in which part-time civilian soldiers, civilian soldiers for short, were viewed. The gentle mockery of some of the public, the patronising attitudes of the regular army, the way some members clearly regarded as being a sort of social club, even the social climbing officer. But the programme also skillfully depicts the platoon as being firmly rooted in the local community, and not least the patriotism and dedication of the civilian soldiers themselves. Regular soldiers were often dubious about the quality and competence of their part-time counterparts, and some simply did not understand why they should spend their time, their spare time, in many cases their own money, to do so. Before 1914, the London Rifle Brigade was regarded by regulars as, quote, a smart lot of cranks. Conversely, the civilian soldiers, I think, admired the skill and professionalism of the regulars, but resented their patronising attitudes and the fact there was, in effect, a glass ceiling on how far they could get. In time of peace, this probably didn't matter too much, but in time of war, it did. Because in both the First and the Second World Wars, the territorials were, of course, critical. They reinforced the regulars and provided a means by which the small peacetime army could expand to wage a total war. And the story of the British in the period 1914 to 45 is at least as much about civilian soldiers as about the professionals, in some case, somewhat more so. I should actually say what I'm going to be talking about today is drawn from a book which I'm working on at the moment, which is called Civilian Armies, which is basically the experience of British and Dominion soldiers across the two world wars. Well, whether in Britain or indeed in the Dominions, volunteering for service was, in many cases, a popular pastime. Because it was so prevalent both in the UK and in settler societies, civilian soldiering was a really important conduit by which military values reached the wider population. It helped militarise these societies in a consensual, non-authoritarian fashion. It also presented, if you like, an alternative model to the stricter, more hierarchical and harsher disciplined regular style of military life. Civilian soldiering, in short, offered an outlet for patriots who did not want to commit to a full-time military career, yet saw military service as the corollary of citizenship. Now, not everybody held such lofty views, as will become clear, but some clearly did. Would it go back, of course, it was the apparent threat of Napoleon III in 1859, which led to the panic, which led to the creation of the rifle volunteer movement, which slotted into place alongside, at that stage, the quite separate yeomanry and militia. And this marks the real beginning of modern auxiliary forces. And of course, the South African War gave civilian soldiers an opportunity to put their hobby into practice. They were not generally employed as whole units. The London Rifle Brigade contributed their CO, two other officers, and 78 rankers to the City Imperial Volunteers, 17 men to the Volunteer Active Service Company of the Royal Fusiliers, and 76 men to the Imperial Yeomanry and the Royal Army Medical Corps. But by the first decade of the 20th century, part-time soldiers could be found the length and breadth of the empire, and I think were firmly established alongside the church and chapel, working man's institute, social club, sports club, as the mainstays of society. The Saturday night soldiers were deeply rooted in local communities. Of course, in August 1914, they looked rather different than they had done at the beginning of the South African War in 1899, thanks to the standing up of the territorial force in 1908. And of course, in the capital, volunteer battalions became part of a newly created London Regiment, which consisted solely of TF units. This was a bit of a problem in some cases. Some units lost sizable numbers of their members. The new terms of enlistment were resented by some of the volunteers, and changes of names and other aspects of reorganisation went down badly. The London Rifle Brigade, the old 1st London Volunteer Rifle Corps, which had the motto Primus in Urbi, first in the city, was renumbered as the 5th Battalion of the London Regiment, and many, many men felt their demotion pretty keenly, and the regiment struggled to get enough men to keep it viable. Well, of course, the territorial force was intended as a million-strong voluntary version of the mass conscript armies of the continent, but the enlistment figures never reached anything like this ambitious target. The fact that on the outbreak of war in 1914, London had an entire territorial regiment of 28 battalions to itself highlights the importance of the national capital in civilian soldiering. It was by far the largest city in Britain and indeed the empire. It was different because of other cities because of its sheer size. The administrative county of London, which was set up in 1888, by 1901 it had a population of 4.5 million, but with another 1.4 million living in the more broadly defined Greater London area. By 1931, the population of the county had fallen slightly, but Greater London had swelled to 3.8 million. In other words, people were going out into suburbs, my grandparents among them. And this gave territorial units in London a very large pool of potential recruits. London, of course, attracted migrants from other parts of the UK, the empire, and indeed elsewhere. So the territorials in London contained numbers of people who were not born in London, or at least their sons. The Belfast-born actor Sam Kidd, who joined the Queen Victoria Rifles in 1938, more of which anon, is just one example. Now, London's sheer size meant that in the First World War, it produced a prodigious number of units. The Royal Fusiliers, the City of London Regiment, raised 47 battalions. And of course, the Territorial London Regiment had 82 battalions, with 2nd, 3rd and even 4th line units being created in addition to 1st line units that were in place in August 1914. The capital also spent, if you like, spare men to regiments in other parts of the country. I wasn't at all surprised to find an East End Jewish lad who was killed while serving in the Royal Dublin Fusiliers in 1917. Well, the diversity of auxiliary units in the capital is dazzling. These included ethnic units, which allow the expression of national identities within an imperial context. So the 14th London's, London Scottish, the 18th London's, London Irish Rifles, and they had their counterparts in other cities of the empire, of course. Similarly, there was a colonial identity, the King Edward's Horse, the King's Overseas Dominion Regiment, which was a London-based special reserve unit founded in 1901 with origins as Imperial Yeomanry in the South African War. Well, the London Regiment's order of battle also featured units that were centred on occupations. Whoops, something has gone wrong there. That's what it should be. The 8th London's, the Post Office Rifles, the 15th London's Civil Service Rifles, and of course, individual companies within battalions recruited from particular firms and industries. And also, of course, because London was so big, some units recruited very specific parts of the metropolis. The 10th London's, nicknamed the Hackney Gurkhas, just one case in point. But to a large extent, in London and other cities, recruitment by units was influenced by social class. Territorials were overwhelmingly working class on the eve of the First World War, but many of them were respectable working men. Well, what this means is that units such as the Cast Iron 6th, the 6th London's, with one company recruited largely from the South Metropolitan Gas Company, was more typical of the TF than the middle-class Queen Westminster Rifles, the 16th London's. And again, class corps, so corps such as the Queen's Westminsters, the London Rifle Brigade, the London Scottish and so on, recruited men from white-collar jobs, on the whole, from a higher social bracket than most other units. And again, this is not unique to London. You find the Liverpool Scottish, you find the Cape Town Highlanders and so on and so forth. Well, this social disparity could cause problems. In early 1939, as the threat of war increased, some units were overwhelmed by volunteers, while gaping holes remained in the ranks of others. War Office's solution? Fine. If you've got more recruits for one battalion, send them off to another one. But this did not go down well with Major General Claude Leaday, I think that's how he pronounced his name, who was the commander of the London Division and a rare territorial, actually commanding a territorial division. Drawing examples, if you like, from left and right of Arc, he declared, "You're not going to get boys who earmark themselves for London Rifle Brigade to go to the Tower Hamlets Rifles." In other words, he thought that people who wanted to go into the posh LRB would not willingly go with a bunch of working class cockneys. Now, the extent to which territorial units retained their character during the Great War is a very interesting one. With very good reason, Bill Mitchison ended his important book on the territorials in the Great War in 1916, because he argues that the turnover of personnel as a result of casualties and the assigning of replacements to units other than their original ones, and the replacement of pre-war territorial force officers with others, perhaps regulars who didn't have any sympathy for the territorial ethos, meant that by the end of the war, nominally territorial units actually bore very little resemblance to their pre-war identities and had become part of a de facto national army. Well, big changes came about in 1921 when the TF was reconstructed as the Territorial Army. Superficially, little had changed. I think the most important thing was that the TA was now more firmly integrated into the national defence setup, and as one TA soldier, now the terrier does not engage to defend the soil of his country, he also engages to fight his country's battles overseas, which is a very different matter. In other words, they could be deployed anywhere, they weren't just for home service. Some territorial units were not reformed, some changed their roles, so the Surrey Yeomanry amalgamated with the Sussex Yeomanry and was converted into a mounted regiment into Royal Artillery. And of course, in the 1930s, many territorial units, including the Honourable Artillery Company, was converted to an anti-aircraft role. In fact, the HAC were already deployed to defend London when war broke out in September 1939. Okay, well, in 1921, C.J. Blomfield, a veteran officer of the Artists Rifles, said that there were five types of peacetime civilian soldiers. Men who had plenty of spare time and devoted practically all of it to the corps. Second, keen men whose spare time was strictly limited by the decisions of their civilian occupations. Thirdly, the average member who makes a more or less respectable sort of show in the matter of shooting attendance at drill. The fourth one was lazy and efficient slackers, and the fifth one were rotters. Now, some men undoubtedly enlisted because they wanted to soldier, but as Bloomfield's categories hints, some had somewhat more mixed motives. Wearing a uniform was a rite of passage in terms of masculinity or manliness, as it would have been called in that time. And in fact, riding horses was a real bonus for why people should want to join yeomanry regiments in urban areas. Part of the Surrey Yeomanry actually trained on Clapham Common. Sounds perhaps slightly bizarre, but of course, at a time when the horses were starting to disappear from London streets, the chance to sort of get on a horse and ride it and go hunting, what have you, was a real enticement for people to join up. Auxiliary service could also appeal to individuals with a love of technology. In 1939, a recruiting drive for the TA, including the appearance of state-of-the-art Bren carriers, which really had a big impression on some people's minds. Len Flanagan joined the Warwickshire Yeomanry, at that stage still a horsed unit, in the summer of 1938. He obviously relished the Thursday evening parades and working on horses, but one of the big attractions for him was they used to have a get-together in the nearest pub. And he talks about his motivations for joining up. Interestingly, considering he joined in summer of 1938, he doesn't mention the growing threat of war. The social aspect of civilian soldiering, of course, was always incredibly important, particularly going to camp. Were camps particularly good ways of training people? Well, possibly not, because some territorials could only get away for part of the camp. Because of the sort of need to give these working men a holiday, you couldn't have their noses to the grindstone all the time. So, you know, they were very enjoyable. They built esprit de corps. The extent to which they actually contributed to training is slightly questionable. The basic problem is, of course, is that territorials were part-timers. As one journalist put, they're 50% soldier, 50% civilian. Actually, 50% soldier is probably being slightly generous. No matter how keen individuals were, careers, families, putting bread on the table had to take priority. One London territorial officer calculated that in a year, if a territorial attended 100 drills and 15 days annual camp, he will, with good fortune, do about 160 hours training as a specialist. The problem, something else which interfered with territorial efficiency, was there was always a high turnover of personnel. Quite simply, it was very easy, if you didn't like being a territorial, to give up and go home. More stringent conditions of service were introduced in the 1930s, and Sam Kidd enlisted in 1938, partly because of the Munich crisis, but mainly because his girlfriend offered to let him have sex with her if he joined up. After 5 weeks of playing at soldiers with his gallant band of civilians, as Kidd put it, he simply stopped turning up to parade. In his own mind, he'd left the territorials. But in the following year, as war with Germany became imminent, he was shocked to receive a telegram calling him up. Sam Kidd was captured at Calais in May 1940 with the Queen Victoria Rifles and spent 5 years as a prisoner of war. 45 years later, when he was a famous actor, Sam reflected on his enlistment and subsequently making love to his girlfriend and decided neither was worth it. I think Captain Blomfield would have counted him as a rotter. Okay, the regular army in the Second World War, I think, took on board the lessons of the First and decided that they actually had to colonise the territorial forces, basically by replacing territorial officers, certainly commanding officers, as far as possible with regulars. One victim of this was Donald Dean, who actually won the Victoria Cross in the First World War, was basically sacked as commander of the 4th Buffs in October 1939 because his divisional commander said there's no way a territorial officer can possibly have the same degree of experience and training as a regular, which actually is probably true, but nonetheless it's extremely harsh on somebody like Dean. And then in 1938, as the threat of war increased, the territorials had been very much in the doldrums in the interwar periods, defence cuts, what have you, hitting them, suddenly became relevant again and recruiting picked up. The doubling of the TA and introduction of conscription announced in quick succession 1939 led to a flood of volunteers. Basically, if you didn't want to be conscripted, joining the territorial army was a good way of ensuring at least you got to choose which unit you had to join. And so old hands were reminded of the scenes from August, September 1914. The wheel had turned again, in other words. As in the 1914-18 war, the degree to which territorial units retained their civilian soldiering character under conditions of total war was affected by the turnover of personnel and the replacement of territorial officers by regulars who did not buy into the territorial ethos. Certainly by the end of the war, Second World War, many nominally TA units had lost their territorial identity, but pockets of territorialism still remain, which I think is also true in the First World War. Well, to conclude, part-time soldiering in the 20th century in Britain was a social and military phenomenon of enormous significance, which despite the heroic labour of historians, many of whom are here today, has not yet received the attention that it deserves. We have some excellent overviews and some fascinating case studies, but we need to go deeper. The London Pride Project, looking in depth at the territorials of the capital in the era of the Great War, I think is a really, really important step. And given the strength of the continuities I've outlined, I hope there's a London Pride too, taking the story from the establishment of the TA to the end of the Second World War. And no, I'm not volunteering to take the lead on that. I hope my remarks this morning have helped set the context for today's discussions. And I'm looking forward to some very interesting sessions. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman.
and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS2195. Until next time.